In this episode, we're talking with Carlos Cacho, Chief Economist at Jarden Australia, and we're going to explore some of the underlying drivers of the property market in 2024, such as who or what is driving this continued run of price increases. How are mortgage holders managing their repayments now that nearly every COVID-era fixed rate has expired? And looking at the tension in the economy with cost of living pressures and inflation, what needs to happen before we will start to see some interest rate cuts?
Welcome to The Elephant in the Room. This is the podcast where we love to talk about the big things in property that never usually get talked about. I'm Veronica Morgan, real estate agent, buyer's agent and buyer's agent mentor, co-host of Foxtel's Location, Location, Location Australia, author of Auction Ready and co-host of Your First Home Buyer Guide.
And I'm Chris Bates, mortgage broker, recently ranked number 5 in Australia out of over 18,000 brokers in the annual MPA Top 100 Mortgage Broker Award. Before we get started, I need to let you know that nothing we say here can be taken as personal advice. We always recommend you engage the services of an appropriate and experienced professional.
Our guest today is Carlos Cacho, Chief Economist at Jarden Australia. Carlos's research covers all things Australian economics and banks with a strong focus on the housing market. Now, we have had Carlos on the podcast before, and we're very thrilled to have you back. Thank you very much. It's been a while since we've had you on The Elephant.
Thanks for having me again.
Carlos, I always love the chats, which you know. I'm just reading through some of your latest reports, which you kindly shared with us. And, I made a really interesting one, which I think is a bit different to what you see perpetuated out there and things that we've spoken about on the podcast around, you know, the ability for AFRA to reduce the serviceability buffer. And as rates go down, that leads to increased borrowing capacity. And what's your article was basically saying the opposite. Maybe AFRA should be increasing its serviceability buffer and maybe RBA shouldn't cut rates, it should increase rates. So I'd love to have this discussion on why you think that and, why is doing an article?
Well, look, I don't think the RBA needs to hike anymore. I think we're at the peak and we will get cuts. I don't think they're probably going to be a bit slower than people expect. But on the APRA serviceability buffer, at least what we know from what APRA's told us is that their framework for that is it's going to range between 2 and 5%. It's currently 3. It was 2.5 until October 2021. And what that means is that 3% is actually still in the, in the lower half of that 2 to 5% range. What our view is that now that buffer, if it really is a 2 to 5% range, then it should probably be around the middle of that range when interest rates are around the middle of the RBA's range. Now, where's that middle of the RBA's range? Well, their estimates suggest their neutral rate, which is essentially what economists think of as the interest rate that is neither stimulatory or contractionary for the economy, is somewhere around maybe around 3.5 or so. And in our view, what that means is probably the APRA buffer, should probably maybe be around 3.5 when the RBA rate is around 3.5. And then in an ideal world, what you would do is you'd you would adjust that buffer down as rates increased and you'd adjust it up as rates fell. The idea being that you actually don't want to bring in too much cyclicality in the housing market. And you don't want to be, what we've seen in the past, particularly over the last 5 years through COVID and then the kind of fall in house prices as the RBA started hiking rates, it's just massive changes in borrowing capacity, up 30%, down 30%. And that brings in a lot of volatility. And it also just makes it harder for buyers to figure out what's in their range. And the risk is, I think if we go back to 2021, if someone, I don't think anyone was expecting the cash rate to go up to 4%. Certainly not the banks. They were testing people at only 2.5% above their interest rates. There's a lot of people that are now rates well above what the banks assumed. And so having a bit more of a proactive buffer or a bit more of a counter-cyclical buffer could help reduce some of those swings through the market. You'd still get the benefit of lower rates in terms of supporting household cash flow, giving people more money to spend. But what you would reduce is the big swings in borrowing capacity where interest rates are really the biggest driver in the short term when they do change.
Why don't you just put a set figure then and just say, look, we're just going to always assess at 8% regardless of what the rate is?
Well, they did that before. Remember back in 2019, they used to assess there was 7 minimum of 2% above the rate or 7.25%. And we had that for a while and then APRA at the time, so that was permanent. And then in July 2019, they changed the 2.5% buffer. At the time, the thinking was, well, rates have come down. We want to support the housing market a bit. Credit growth is really weak. And so they moved away from that. I think if it, as it changes, it gives you more room to maneuver within the interest rate space. The other thing is, you know, in terms of people who are calling for it to be lowered, if I look across the, you know, the credit space, the housing market lending space, it doesn't look to me like an environment where, you know, we necessarily need to add more fuel to the fire. The housing market is chugging along at a pretty decent clip. You know, we've seen prices make new highs every month. We're seeing price growth kind of annualizing in the mid to high single digits. Credit growth has troughed and is now picking up. Lending growth, it's been some ups and downs, but it's generally kind of on an upward trajectory again. So it doesn't look to me like an environment where you need to cut that serviceability buffer. There is an argument that from an affordability standpoint, it would help, but I don't think APRA's policy is the right tool to do that. Affordability should not be something that we're relying on the RBA or APRA to fix. That's something that we need the government to step up to and fix with policy, not just relying on throwing more credit into the system, which is going to make the problem worse for the next generation.
So you've got a few friends of the heads of the banks. I mean, that's what you've covered for many years, right? There is a bit of a story that they're already perpetuating in the media, though, that the higher assessment rates is really constraining borrowing capacity and it's favouring people on higher incomes. But are you sort of saying, look, I know that's definitely true, right? You've got a report that's got that title and you've got evidence to back that up. But do you think that it's a bit of a false belief that, you know, if they do decrease the serviceability buffer, all that will do will very quickly get factored into prices? And are you really creating affordability, or are you just creating more price growth and more credit growth? Is that sort of your take on, you know, yeah, banks obviously say they care about affordability, but really they just care about credit growth?
Well, I mean, look, I think banks do care about affordability in the sense that they want to be able to, you know, write more mortgages to greater share of the Australian population. And in the short term, yes, cutting the APRA buffer would help there, but it's not going to drive a sustainable improvement in affordability. What we've seen whenever we've seen these sorts of changes, whether it's rate cuts, whether it's changes in the APRA buffer, whether it's some government incentives like first home buyers grants and the like, is that relatively quickly we see that factored into prices. And then what happens is, well, the next generation of, you know, be they first home buyers or upgraders in 2 years' time is now just facing an even bigger hurdle to get into the market. So I think really, like, look, housing affordability is a massive problem. From a mortgage affordability standpoint, it's never been worse. Relative to incomes, they're a bit down from the highs we've seen previously, but they're still very elevated. It's harder than ever for you know, young people to get into the market given where prices are. But I think using interest rates and macroprudential policy as the tools to address that is not the right approach. And that's really something that, you know, I think governments need to address. And I think, look, in my view, I think we've kind of kicked the can down the road in affordability for a long time in Australia through rate cuts and buyer incentives and whatnot over the last 20 years. And we're now at the stage where, you know, the sort of first home buyer grant you'd need to give someone to really give them material assistance to get into the market is just so large that it's, you know, it's really unfeasible. It's not like $10,000 is really going to touch the sides anymore.
Yeah. I mean, it's just rhetoric. I mean, we should just probably give up on this argument even, you know, really. I mean, isn't that horses bolters? Is that what you're saying? Just like...
Oh, look, more or less. I mean, there are, you know, there's things we can do. Certainly, supply is part of the solution. Changing expectations around housing. You know, we do need more medium density. If you look at Sydney compared to other big global cities, we have a very, you know, we're not a very dense city compared to somewhere like London or New York. And so there is an argument that we should try and increase the density. And how much that helps affordability is just going
to
be.
The first thing that comes to my mind when you say that is, well, they're not known for being affordable cities to live in. You know, like, you can have lots of property. Will that materially change things? I think a lot of people come out and say supply is the answer, but that seems to be what the politicians are all saying. And the minute politicians all get on the same bandwagon, I'm worried about it.
I mean, look, supply is needed. I don't think it's purely the answer. I think if you, you know, see some of the arguments that, oh, we just need a up zone and the private sector would build it. Well, look, the private sector is not going to crash housing prices. It's not in the interest of a private developer to sell so many apartments or so many houses that they crash the market. That's not going to happen. In my view, what we probably need to sustainably improve affordability is a much more active public sector. That's both in the form of providing affordable and social housing, as well as being a developer for all cycles. Someone who's in the market building, whether prices are rising at 10 or 20% a year or whether they're falling. And what we see the private sector developers generally do is we see, pull forward of projects, speed up of activity when prices are rising, when the market's strong, when demand's there. And then when demand drops away, rather than dropping prices to kind of keep up with the supply, they hold prices and wait till demand comes back. If we had a sizable public sector presence in the housing market, that could be quite different. And we used to, back in prior to the 1990s, the public sector built one out of every 10 houses in Australia. Now they're building about two out of every 100. Mm-hmm. So there has been a big drop in their participation. If you look at cities like Singapore, private housing for an expat is not cheap. It's a very expensive city. Land is very limited. But for locals, there is essentially an outside public option, which is very affordable. And look, it's not going to be the most glamorous of housing, but it gives people a place to a roof over their head that they can own. And so I think we do just need to start thinking about other ways of doing this, because clearly, the situation in our capital cities is not really sustainable for young people. And we're seeing that play out with New South Wales Productivity Commission released a report earlier this year about the huge numbers of essentially prime age workers, young families leaving the city. Now, in net terms, they're being replaced by migrants and a bit of migration into the city from the regions. But that, high housing costs as they are is not great for the economy. It reduces the dynamism of the economy. It makes it harder for people to move to where the opportunities may be for them, or even just to where life may be better. And I think, another big part of the problem is transaction costs, as you two would know well. Like, it costs a lot to move as an owner-occupier. You're looking at 8-9% of dwelling values once you start adding up all the costs involved.
Yeah.
A biggest one is, of course, stamp duty. And in my view, I think, moving to a broad-based land tax would be a much better approach. But it's politically difficult because, one, you lose money initially doing that. And two, you're obviously going to upset a lot of people who aren't paying anything at the moment or have owned their properties for a long time. But I'm not sure if we're going to have someone with the political capital or will to do that, but that would be very high up on my agenda of ways to improve housing or the allocation of our existing housing supply.
Well, it's also a state-based tax, and the ACT has moved towards that transition in that transition period at the moment. But the New South Wales previous government tried it, and even when they brought it in a really tinkering, tiny way for first home buyers, it was set up so that if those buyers subsequently sell, it's going to go back to stamp duty anyway. So you can see how difficult it is for those who say they want to change the tax system. And even then it's capped so that higher income or higher value properties were outside of that as well. So it's messy. One of the things that's interesting is looking at the way prices have continued rising in the face of cost of living pressures and rising interest rates and all the other things that are going on. And also it's accepted that the economy is slowed in terms of growing as well. We're not in recession again, but, we certainly have seen a slower rate of growth over the last, I think, month on month for the last how many months. So given that that's the case, we're still seeing prices rising nationally, not in every city, but in most. Why do you think that that's the case?
Well, I think what a lot of people, myself included, really underestimated is there's two things. One, how limited supply, particularly of high quality, family homes is. Mm. With borrowing capacity down 30%, there's a lot of people who would love to move but can't afford to. There's a whole, and with the rises in prices we've seen over the last 5 years, there's a lot of people who are, they might be living in a $3 million home, but they can't really afford a $3 million home. If they were to have to go out into the market and buy it now. Mm. So supply has still been really limited, both in terms of total stock on market is around the lowest on record and new stock coming onto market. Now, we're starting to see that change. We're seeing auction volumes calendar year to date are up 40% year on year. There's been some strong rises, albeit I think a lot of that is quite driven by units as investors in particularly Sydney and Melbourne have been exiting the market. The other factor is just that we underestimated was the number and kind of strength of non-interest rate sensitive buyers. And by that, it's really people who either have cash or, you know, significant wealth to back them up. And we see that through data from the banks, which shows the share of buyers earning over $200,000 a year, or share of mortgage applicants earning $200,000 a year, has soared to over a third of applicants from less than 20% going back a couple of years ago. So really the market has become dominated by higher income buyers who are less impacted by the changes in borrowing capacity, and also buyers having larger deposits, using more cash. We can see the ratio between the value of home sales and the value of home loans that it financing those sales is at a record low.
Right.
We've seen things like higher LVR lending has come right down. As I'm sure Chris would know well, like, you know, it's not very often you see people going up into that kind of 85, 90% LVR anymore. It's just hard to make work. And we also, you know, we know PEXA released their annual report on cash buyers, I think about 2 weeks ago, and that showed a record share across the eastern states of buyers using cash. So it's also retirees who might be selling the family home, downsizing, or moving to a lifestyle area, freeing up some capital. They're buying in cash, and they're probably giving some cash to their adult children to help them, you know, either get into the market or take that next step. And it's funny, you know, we put out a note, a bit of research last year, survey of brokers around the use of Bank of Mum and Dad for customers. We estimated that probably about 70% of first home buyers are now receiving some form of family assistance, either guarantees, cash gifts, or loans. And after we put that out, I was inundated with stories and anecdotes from family, friends, clients around, you know, just how much this is going on. And look, it is probably a biased sample. You know, I live in the inner ring of Sydney. I work in finance, you know, but I think this is, you know, you see it all through the media. You know, there is a lot of money out there, you know, that the older generations have, and a lot of it's been made in property. And people are helping their families, helping their kids get into the market. And I think that's what we underestimate, is just how much that money would come through and support buyers. And what it means is essentially the people who are playing in the market now, it's a bit more concentrated. It's higher income. It's more cash. They're less sensitive to rates. And generally, they're looking, you know, for the more high quality properties close to the CBD. And so that's why I think you're seeing quite a big difference between what we're seeing in the established housing market versus what we're seeing in the new housing market, where sales for things like house and land on the suburban fringe are really struggling. You know, they're troughed, but they're not picking up, nowhere near what you're seeing in the established market. And that's because the cohort of buyers who are active in the established market are not the same type of buyer who wants to buy a house and land package on the suburban fringe. Those buyers are really priced out at the moment.
Wow.
So you've done some amazing research where you said listings and auction numbers are up. Auction numbers generally also correlate to housing, right, rather than apartments. Yeah. So are you still seeing there's a real mismatch, though, where units, apartments, listing numbers are, you know, all-time highs, you know, 10-decade high highs. Houses and the owner-occupied market's more in that market rather than investors. They're really still at all-time lows, and that mismatch is, so the total numbers looking much positive. When you break down the numbers, it's not giving confidence to the family trying to buy a house.
There's definitely a big mismatch between the stock on market for apartments versus houses, though that is starting to shift a bit in Sydney and Melbourne. At least we are seeing more houses come onto the market, though the other capitals, Brisbane, Adelaide, Perth, you know, in particular, houses are still, you know, stock on market is still really hard to come by. So I think it is getting better, and you know, part of that is I think there's a couple of drivers of that. You know, first of all, you got, you know, some investors who bought houses. I know around me, I live in the inner city suburb of Waterloo, around Waterloo Redfern. I'm seeing a lot of ex-investor stock coming to the market now, and I think it's people who've either decided they've made some great money there over the last 10, 20 years. There's a metro line about to open soon. It's a good time to sell. Plus, interest rates are higher, as they may be facing a bit of a pinch on their cash flow. Secondly, you've got people have gotten over the psychological hurdle of being, you know, house prices being down. People, you know, we don't like to sell at a loss, even if it's not a real loss. You know, people look at where prices were at the peak in 2021, 2022. They didn't want to sell below that. Now that we've made new highs again, that allows more people to come onto the market. And what I think you'd be the final factor is just kind of a bit more upgrader activity. It's still hard. It's still not heaps of it. but you are seeing a bit more of, it does seem a little bit more of that upgrader activity. I do think the tightness in the construction sector and the lack of new housing, though, is a bit of an impediment there, where, you know, renovation costs are through the roof. And so the prospect of buying a house that's a bit shabby and you can add value to and renovate is not nearly as attractive as it probably was 3 or 4 years ago. Certainly if you don't have the skills and the knowledge to and know how to really do that well. Like, you know, if you're not a tradie, if you're an economist like me, I know that's not my advantage, working on a reno. I've got a good friend who's a carpenter, and him and his wife have done some amazing renovations that they've done really well out of that, but it takes a lot of elbow grease and they do all of the work themselves.
Do you think, Carlos, there's a bit of a listings numbers may be a little bit optimistic? You know, I think this happened in winter last year where, you know, they came up a lot, they kind of rose a lot faster earlier than they usually do in spring. And then there was all this, there's everyone rushing to sell. And what people were doing were front running, right? They were listing properties earlier last year so they could get when there was low stock. So, and then all of a sudden everyone listed early, and then obviously there was a decent amount of stock on the market, right? Because all the agents were saying list earlier. So you think that might be the case here as well, where, you know, we saw really high numbers in February and March, but maybe, you know, Easter was a bit earlier, you know, school holidays, maybe we're not going to see that play out in April and May, and we're going to be disappointed again and go, actually, maybe there isn't lots of listings coming.
Yeah, look, definitely the seasonality in the housing market is always there, and this year in particular it's pretty stark because Easter is so early, it's, you know, the end of March, and so, you know, everyone kind of pulled forward their activity, and then there's probably going to be a bit of a void. I think we'll probably still see it pick up, but I think, yeah, look, absolutely the strength we saw in February and March probably overstated what's going to happen. But it does, you know, there has been a consistent pickup in Sydney and Melbourne, and I think the rise in prices, the rise in lending, the greater confidence that I think buyers are having from rates being at least on hold, and, you know, some people factoring in rate cuts potentially, is also playing through. But we're just going to have to wait and see. I mean, the big question I actually had, you know, going to this year was, if we do see a big rise in listings, is demand going to be deep enough to actually meet that? And for me, that's still a question that I'm uncertain of. So far, it has met that, but I'm just wondering, is that just that there's a backlog of demand and it's meeting it? Because at the end of the day, borrowing capacity still is down 30% for most buyers. Now, a lot of them will have had decent income growth. You know, they might have kind of brought down their expectations of where they're buying, but that does mean still that your pool of buyers is going to be a lot less than what there would have been in 2021 and what there might normally be.
We've seen that. I mean, my business, Good Deeds, is in Sydney, and so I can't speak to Melbourne on that, but I do watch things like, you know, the total number of Sydney listings for auction. I look at the withdrawal rate as well, because that tells me the confidence of vendors and agents of getting their prices. And then I also look at, you know, the clearance rate, obviously, and how sustainable that is. We've had two super Saturdays this year, both of which were just over 1,000 listings, which is more than we'd had in any one week over the previous 12 months. And both of them had clearance rates, according to Domain anyway, in excess of 70%, which is a seller's market, right? But, you know, it's been a bit flabby. Like, it's sort of, we've seen the clearance rates drop into the 60s for a few weeks as well. So when I looked at Cooley Auctions come out with their data every month. I don't know if you look at it, Carlos. And I look at they do hundreds of auctions across Sydney. So it's not the whole market, but maybe it's 25%, 30% of the market. And, you know, it's really interesting. Sorry, that's not true. That's a month versus week. So forget that I just said 25, 30% of the market. Let's divide that by four. But like, I look at that because they report on the amount of registered bidders per auction, for example, and then the amount of properties that sell above reserve and things like that, sort of dig deeper underneath the clearance rate. I find that quite fascinating because you can see that the pool of buyers is shallower than it was even a year ago. The confidence in terms of property selling over auction, over reserve, that's at a higher rate. So perhaps vendors are more realistic as well. There's two aspects to the reserve. But I do love sort of getting into the nitty gritty and understanding it more in a micro sense, because these macro numbers can, you know, they can give us false comfort. But if we sort of look at, you know, in deeper, we can get more of a sense of how sustainable this is. So I agree with you that we can't derive huge confidence because we've had good clearance rates on some high listings weekends.
Yeah, I think that's the big, it's just like how deep is that pool of buyers? If we do see listings remain at these really elevated levels for, not weeks, but potentially months as we move through the year, if they move higher, can the strength of the market be sustained? And I think what you're already starting to see is buyers feeling like there's a lot more choice out there, and so they can be pickier. And so, we saw it last year with, big divergences between the, brand new, fresh renovated house and the one that's, still got the 80s kitchen in it. And I think that's going to continue where people are going to, they're not going to compromise so much. They're going to, they've got the feeling like, look, there's more houses coming up. We're not worried that if we miss out on this one, it's going to be another 3 months before we see something.
Yeah.
Look, this week, it's pretty quiet, Christmas, Easter, school holidays coming up, Anzac Day coming up at the end of April. So April is probably going to be a quieter month, but I think what you are seeing is buyers feel like there's more choice, and so they're being a bit more selective in what they look at. Now, I think there's still a lot of competition for high quality properties, on the nice streets, in the good spots. I know my wife and I are starting the process of looking around a bit, and we've been surprised at some results. That of houses that we went through and looked at, and we thought, oh, this might be something we have a shot at, and it's just, gone through some stupid numbers. But then others equally are, kind of around what you'd expect to see. So I think there's still really those ups and downs depending on the property. It's certainly not a kind of, super strong, everything's going to sell well above reserve market like we saw in 2021, where money was free and people were just trying to get something no matter what it was.
So I think you hit some. I think the market was definitely slowing down the tail end, right? There was that buyer fatigue coming into 2024, but I think everyone was surprised. The confidence around interest rates, and we'll go to this in the next part of the show. That confidence around interest rate cuts coming in 2024 was quite high at the start of the year, right? And so we saw a new, optimism from buyers. And I think you're right around the upgraders. We absolutely have seen that. I can think of a number of clients who have transacted in March that have been wanting to upgrade for years and actually want to get in before rate cuts, before borrowing capacity gets up, because they're more confident now around work. They're more confident where potentially rates are going to end up. Their home or their current property is still selling quite well. And they can make that jump, and they're confident around their future financially with an income point of view. And so I do think there's some upgraders there, and then there's all that intergenerational wealth. But you're right, they're absolutely picky, right? So they're not feeling FOMO and feeling like, if I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it. I'm just going to be patient. And I think that choice, if they are picky, they're just going to be really selective on what they buy, right? So they're going to see this, probably still turning over really fast in the market, right? Because all the buyers are going to go there like a seagull to a chip, and then the stuff that's compromised is really going to hold back. And so I think you're going to see that mismatch. So interest rates, Carlos, you mentioned maybe the RBA is at the top of the cycle and maybe shouldn't increase them. But, what's your take on, where we're at in that journey? Is the inflation back in the bottle? Are we going to get this soft landing? Are we going to get a much, higher rates for longer result? What's your take on where we are?
Look, we think, we're probably at the top of the cycle. Inflation's moving in the right direction, but I think it's too early to declare victory. We know a lot of services components are still quite sticky. Rents are still rising at 7 to 10% a year. We expect that's going to continue for a while. If we look at rents as they're measured in the CPI versus what we see in asking market rents from CoreLogic or SQM, there's still a really big gap there. We still need to see about another 20% rise in CPI rents for them to catch up with what CoreLogic data is showing, and even more versus SQM. And that's the second biggest item in the CPI basket. That's going to be a challenge. New housing costs, so essentially construction costs, are the biggest item. They're still rising at 5%, 5% annualized. So it's better. We're seeing the goods deflation, we're seeing the tradable inflation come down, but not every line item is heading in the same direction. So our view is it is going to be a little bit longer before we get rate cuts. We don't see them coming until February 2025, so it's still just under 12 months away. And when they do come, we think it is going to be a bit more of a shallower easing. We only expect 3 rate cuts, with the cash rate getting to about 3.6%, so still well above where we were even pre-COVID, let alone at the lows we got to. I think, you know, we do think a soft landing is happening. The labor market is, the heat's coming out of it, but it's still quite strong, you know. The latest data has been very volatile, December, January, February, some big moves in the unemployment rates and big moves in jobs, kind of both up and down. But I think what we are seeing is just that gradual softening in unemployment. But it's very quite dependent on the sector. You know, we know that consumer exposed areas are doing it tougher. Retail and hospitality have both seen net job losses over the last year. On the other hand, public sector exposed parts of the economy are doing a lot better. So we actually estimated that a third of all jobs growth over the last year was driven partially by the NDIS, in our view, by essentially kind of healthcare and social assistance services. So there's a really big divergence between kind of some different segments there. And if we look, we see that also in wages where, you know, for example, health sector wages are going up a lot. Now, some of those wages were started on a lower base, but they've had really strong growth. Whereas traditionally pretty high paid sectors like finance, wages are now softening, employment's fairly soft. And it's not a particularly buoyant time in the financial services industry. It's a lot of, you know, big banks are looking to cut costs and financial markets aren't seeing as much activity as they did in the boom. So there are some big differences through the market. But overall, I think things still remain certainly better than what you would assume based on reading the headlines in the news on a daily basis.
I'm on a personal mission to help more people make better property decisions. And you can find out all about what I'm working on at veronicamorgan.com.au. And there you'll find resources for first home buyers, details about my buyer's agent mentoring program, access to suburb help for investors, or if you're looking to buy your dream home or an investment property in Sydney's inner west, eastern suburbs, or lower north shore, you can connect with my team at Good Deeds Property Buyers.
If you're thinking about buying your first home, upgrading to a new one, or purchasing an investment property anywhere in Australia, we would love to carefully guide you through this journey and importantly, get the finance right. Please reach out via our website, wealthful.com.au.
Carlos, I wouldn't want to take this like a longer term view here for a second. So how did we get it so wrong, right? When I was working in the UK back in 2007, rates went to zero, right? And they were zero all the way up till 2022. You know, we had the world was turning Japanese, right? You know, that we couldn't get wage growth. Inflation was, rates were at all time lows. We can't get them off zero. We're talking about negative rates not that long ago. This short term, the COVID issues, right? And the supply chain and, are we just going through that process, right, and working through all that stimulus? And are we end up going to get up to a situation where we were a few years ago where growth and productivity and, you know, technology, and we're going to start heading in the other direction again and potentially having to try to stimulate growth and cutting rates. And we're going to be looking for where our next productivity growth is going to, and GDP growth is going to come from. Do you think that's where we're going?
Look, I think we've moved out of that decade period of really low rates of struggling to get inflation. I think there's a couple of reasons for that. One of the biggest ones is just fiscal policy, what governments are doing. For most of the 10 years pre-COVID, governments around the world were really in austerity mode. They were trying to pull back spending. They were trying to get their budgets back to more balance or more of a surplus. Remember in Australia, Josh Frydenberg had his mug back in black when he was expecting the first budget, the surplus in, you know, almost, I think it was over a decade. Didn't quite get there with COVID, but we've got there now. Now we've got there not because the government's cut spending, but because revenue's been way better than expected. Income growth's been really strong. So income taxes have been strong. Commodity prices have been elevated. Company profits have been strong. And so the budget's in a really good shape. But they're still spending a lot of money. At the state level, we're seeing a huge amount of spending as well. New South Wales had a massive upgrade to their budget last year, a lot of that because of stamp duty as the housing market turned around and volume started to improve. They didn't really have a net improvement on the bottom line, though, because a lot of that ended up being spent in new initiatives. And we're seeing this around the world where really the pre-COVID obsession with austerity and fiscal consolidation has ended. And we've got, you know, emboldened governments where they're now realizing, you know, we can actually have a more meaningful impact. In the US, you've got a really strong economy, very low unemployment, and they're running 7-8% GDP deficits in the budget. Like, it's just, that's not something you'd expect to see outside of a crisis or a war previously. So you've got much more expansionary fiscal policy. You've also got a couple of mega trends going on that I think are going to mean inflation is going to be higher than it was for most of the last decade. We've got aging populations now, which means shrinking workforces. Now, Australia's a bit more fortunate than a lot of our global peers in that we do have high levels of migration, which are causing their own issues, but that's keeping our workforce relatively younger. You have this green transition that's going on, the move towards renewables, the move towards electric vehicles, et cetera. That's expensive. That's costly. That requires a lot of commodities, a lot of investment. And deglobalization, that's the last one. So, you know, we spent most of the last 20, 30 years, China being the factory of the world, goods prices coming down. We're actually starting to see that shift now where, if anything, trade barriers are starting to go up. Countries are now looking to have more surety of their supply chain. You know, we're no longer in the just-in-time supply chain management. Companies want to have a bit more wiggle room after the experience that we had during COVID. And we're also starting to see more onshoring or friendshoring of production where, you know, not everyone wants to have all their eggs in one basket anymore, totally relying on China for their production. They want to spread that around a bit more and probably have some of it back home. Particularly in the US, you've seen a massive amount of investment in bringing manufacturing back into the domestic market. And so all of that, all of those things in our view are going to be inflationary. Now, that doesn't mean inflation is going to be running at 7 or 8%. But it probably means, whereas for most of the decade pre-COVID, it was running below 2%, it's probably going to be closer to 3%. And that's going to mean that we're going to have higher interest rates. But for, you know, for governments and for households, that's not a bad thing in terms of a bit higher, but still moderate, you know, manageable inflation. Was that's going to mean you're actually going to get more wages growth. In nominal terms, it's going to be easier to pay back your debt. It actually, a bit of inflation, as long as it's kind of relatively steady and manageable, is actually not a terrible thing.
And the whole transition with climate change and, you know, do you think that's a big driver for inflation and, you know, investment around the world? But that's what's also causing, you know, it gives us...
Yeah, look, in the long term, it is. Like in the short term, you know, it's not always easy to see the effect. But in the long term, you know, I haven't done the numbers myself, but the numbers you see that global groups have estimated it's going to require, you know, in terms of copper or lithium or essentially raw materials to really... know, electrify our societies and complete that transition are just massive, and that's going to require a lot of investment, a lot of money, and that in and of itself is going to be inflationary. Now, maybe the counter to that is on the productivity side. I mean, we'll have to wait and see. But if AI does turn out to be this, you know, massive redefining productivity, tool, and potentially that can help offset some of those effects. You know, if we have an aging population, so a shrinking workforce, but AI actually lets everyone do more with less and automate, maybe those two factors can offset a bit. But overall, I think, if the pre-COVID period was one characterized by unusually low inflation and interest rates, I think the post-COVID period is one that's going to be more normal or slightly elevated interest rates and inflation. And taking an even further step back from that, what we generally have seen over long time periods, I'm talking decades and centuries here, is 20 to 40 year cycles in interest rates, where, you know, what we saw in essentially from the 80s to 2020 is a long-term period of gradually falling interest rates. For the 30 or so years before that, post-World War II, we were in a period of rising interest rates. You see this cycle, different magnitudes, but you see that kind of borne out over time. And the Bank of England has great data on this stuff going back to like the 1600s. And you can see these cycles in interest rates, you know, have played out over decades again and again and again. So our view is we're potentially going into a period where now interest rates aren't going to be up in a straight line, but it just means that kind of on a smooth basis, probably for the next 10, 20 years, we're in an environment where rates are going to be higher than they were for the previous 10 or 20 years.
Smooth sounds good. Obviously, high is still painful for us that remember the very, very low rates of only recent years. And of course, there was a lot of talk about the fixed rate cliff, which turned out to be a bit of a non-event, yet arrears are now on the rise. So I guess what's the magnitude of that problem and how do you look at that if you're thinking that rates are going to continue to be at a higher level over the next decade or so than we've been used to in the last decade?
Look, so fixed rate cliff definitely didn't turn out to be nearly as disastrous as some people feared. We're most of the way through it. We still have about a third of the fixed rate loans to roll off. The really low 2 year stuff is gone, but you know, personally, I've still got a 4 year fixed rate at under 2% that's rolling off in November. So I just wish I fixed more. There's still some of it coming off over the next 2 years. There's a long tail there. What we know from the RBA's recent financial stability review is that there's about 5% of owner-occupied variable mortgage holders who are currently in a negative cash flow position. So that means their mortgage repayments and their essential expenses are above their income. So they're needing to dip into their savings every month to fund that. Now, a lot of them do have significant savings. And so the RBA estimates that about two-thirds of those borrowers have more than 6 months in savings. So I think most people will manage, but there will be some who, you know, who are in a tight position. And what we are, you know, and what they're going to do is, well, they're probably either going to, they may in the end, they might have to look at, you know, cutting their spending even more. They might have to consider, you know, potentially moving out and renting somewhere more affordable if that's an option. Now, that's not always going to be an option given how tight the rental market is and the savings from paying a mortgage or paying rent, not as great as they might normally be. Or in the, you know, in the worst case, they may have to consider selling their home. Now, at the moment in the current market, that's not too concerning in from a kind of system perspective. At the individual level, it's obviously very challenging. You don't want to, you know, discount the difficulty a lot of those households are facing. But at the macro level, you know, I think so far this is very manageable. Arrears are picking up, but they're still at pretty low levels historically. We're only really getting back towards where we were pre-COVID. You know, you're still looking at across the financial system around about still less than 1%. So still very low. And importantly, you know, arrears is just means that if you can't make your repayments, what matters from a bank perspective is loss given default. So essentially, if you default on your mortgage, the bank actually takes a loss on that. And that's likely to be very, very low because negative equity, where people's debt is higher than the value of their asset, is pretty much non-existent. It's somewhere below 1% or 2%, depending on who you ask. And so given what we're seeing in the housing market, unless there's a pretty sharp turn, it does seem like, you know, the majority of borrowers will make it through. There are, you know, no doubt there are people who are doing it tough, but I think in aggregate, it's actually looking okay. But I think the most important thing to factor in with all this is that's kind of assuming now that, you know, you keep your job. The most important factor that's going to drive how challenging this is, how many people potentially, you know, go into arrears or might be forced to sell or go into hardship with their bank is really going to be the labor market. If you can maintain your job, maintain your income, and the labor market remains relatively solid, then I think, you know, we're on track for a pretty smooth, soft landing. If that changes, if we do start to see a deterioration in the labor market and job losses, then obviously that changes changes things a lot. And, you know, the RBA estimates that I think it's 30 or 40% of households have less than 3 months buffer if they were to lose their jobs. So there's a lot of people who, if they were to lose their jobs and not be able to replace that income fairly quickly, would certainly be facing a lot of stress.
Yeah, I can think of a number of clients who preemptively have decided to sell their home. Yeah, I'll be under five, but have bought in recent years. The mortgages run on the, they can still sell their home for a decent price. And they've decided to actually go and enter the market at a lower price point. So they've just, got a more modest home, but it's, you know, in a similar suburb, maybe a few suburbs out, maybe a three bed rather than a four bed. So they've just sort of downsized rather than having a bigger mortgage. I think that's a pretty smart move for some people, you know, when they are, and let's say their confidence around their income isn't as high. And so they're saying, look, if we do have these higher repayments for the next 5 years, it's really going to affect our lifestyle. Whereas if we did, you know, live in a more modest home, yeah, we haven't got as much growth. Yeah, we have to pay transaction costs, but we don't have that peace of mind that, you know, we've got this big mortgage. We've got to make huge lifestyle, you know, pullbacks. So I can see that happening already. When you lose your job, though, it's much harder. And that's a real issue because, you know, you have to sell, you know, if you can't afford your mortgage, then you can't re-enter the market. And so I think that's, and whereas if you, you know, you did downsize, let's say, and then you do lose your job, well, that's okay because your mortgage is usually more manageable and usually you've kept a bit more buffer because in terms of when you downsize. So I can see that happening. Now, Carlos, I think one of your reports is around migration. And I guess people have said that there's been a lot of catch up the last couple of years, you know, stuff with students coming back, you know, expats moving back. What's your take on the next few years? Like, are we still going to be, oh, wow, getting surprised on how many people are moving here and how many people aren't leaving? And, you know, is it still going to be much higher than we expect?
Well, look, based on what we're currently seeing in some of the the high frequency monthly data and migration, it seems, at least in the short term, that yeah, there's still a fair bit of upside. The government's forecast from the budget were that net migration was going to slow from over 500,000 in financial year 23 to about 375,000 in financial year 24. We're expecting that's actually going to be over 400,000. If we look at some of these high frequency data, we're seeing year to date to January, arrivals, net arrivals are tracking over 100,000 ahead of 2023. And so it's slowing, but it's not slowing as fast as expected. The government is looking for ways to tighten this up, but what makes it challenging is most of the migration coming in is not permanent migration, or the permanent migration program, which gives someone residency and they can come in. And a lot of that is people who apply domestically, but there is some offshore arrivals. Most of it's temporary. Most of it's the students and the workers who are coming here. And the thing with their temporary migration system or temporary visa system is it's largely demand-based. Essentially, one way to think about it is the government basically says, here's the box. If you can fit through that box, you can come into Australia. You can change the size of the box, but you can't really change how many people are going to come through based on that size. What they're trying to do at the moment is they're trying to shrink that box a bit. They've increased the English language testing requirements for students. They've increased the money they have to have, or be able to show in their account to come here. It hasn't led to a big decrease in applications yet. What the government is instead doing to manage that is we're seeing rejection rates of student visas shoot right up to around record levels. About a third of all visas are now being rejected, compared to a longer-term average of about 10% for students. The risk is that while migration is stronger in the short term, the government might try to shrink that box a bit too much, and potentially in 2 years' time, we're sitting here and migration is not running at, you know, 220 or 230,000 like they expected, but maybe it's running at 100,000. The other big shift that's going on is really departures that you kind of alluded to there. Arrivals have been strong, but not out of this world. Where the bigger delta has actually arguably been more recently is we haven't had people leaving. And that's largely just a lag thing where no one was arriving 2 years ago in the middle of 2021 to study a degree in Australia. Now, we were still in lockdowns in Sydney and Melbourne. And so no one's leaving having finished their three or four year degree now. Over the next 12 to 24 months, we will start to see a bit more of a normalization in those departures, and that will naturally bring migration down. But in the short term, it is going to be stronger in our view, and that is going to, you know, keep pressure up on rental markets, keep pressure up, you know, on this issue, and it's going to be political. You know, every quarter when the migration numbers come out, the risk is they're going to be higher than expected, and it's going to keep that kind of front and center of the kind of media and politics.
Do you think, Carlos, we're going to be very careful with how we treat, you know, international students and, you know, the desirability? Because we are competing for global talent, right? And do you think that they do bring a lot to our economy, you know, in terms of the money to universities? They bring a lot of money to spending their economy. Some of them stay and we don't pay for their education for 20 years. And, you know, all the costs of bringing up a child in Australia, but then we get them educated in the Australian workforce basically for free. So, do we have to be really careful with how we treat and how, on a global scale, how we appear to be pro-international students rather than against them? And do you think that's a fine line?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, you know, international education is Australia's largest export outside of commodities. It's a massive industry. We are in a global war for talent. You know, Canada, UK, US are all other desirable countries for students to go to. And really, you know, I think people sometimes think the main purpose of kind of student immigration is like, you know, the university's making money or these courses. Really, you know, taking a step back, the bigger desire for students to come is to, you know, have people come to Australia, study here, and then live and work here for their working lives and become taxpayers and contribute to our society. Australia has an aging population, like most of the developed world. We've got shrinking, falling birth rates. How do we offset that? Well, part of it is bringing more young people in. And you can see that in the recent data where the growth of the working age population overall has been about 3% compared to overall population growth of 2.5%. So working age is about 15 to 65. But if you look at the younger cohort within that, the 15 to 25-year-olds, that growth has been 5% over the last year. So massive growth in these younger cohorts. At the moment, that causes some, you know, some teething issues, some stress in the rental market, etc. But over time, if you can keep the best and brightest, you know, they're going to add a lot more over their lives to the economy. So it is a balancing act, but it's also a matter of, you know, trying to select, okay, how can we make sure, I mean, not only are we getting the best people coming here on the visas and the ones who are, you know, genuinely coming to Australia to make a life, but then how do we help them stay? And that's been one of the challenges, is you know, ensuring these students are able to then get into the workforce, have a, you know, a path to permanent residency or citizenship. And that's something that kind of did fall apart previously, where you know, really the bedrock of our student migration system was set in the early 2000s, where there was this essentially path made from international student to permanent resident. That started to break down a bit under the previous government. It's now being reinstated, but it's you know, it is important to try and make sure that we are seen good, you know, well on the global stage, to try and make sure that we can get the best students coming here. And we're not just getting people who want to come here for a while to really just work and remit money back home, which is, you know, the rorting that's often talked about. And there is that going on, but we don't want to tar everyone with the same brush.
There's also the aspect of skills, you know, skills migration, or bringing in skills that we don't have. We've well publicised that we've not been investing in trades, for example. And obviously, if we're wanting to build 1.2 million houses or dwellings over the next 5 years, we've got to get the people and the materials, etc., to build those 1.2 million dwellings, which I think it seems to be commonly accepted. We're never going to make that target. But so in terms of that skills migration, how are we doing with that? Because, are we also competing with other countries for those migrants?
Yeah, we are, definitely to an extent. I mean, there's a lot of skilled migration into the UK and Canada as well, less so the US. In terms of what's driving that, what we see is the biggest areas are IT skills in particular. Healthcare is another big one. So nurses in particular are a key area. There's, you know, a massive shortage of nurses. Vacancies for them are more than two times what they were pre-COVID. And then also kind of at the lower end of kind of, I guess, skills, depending on how you look at it, we see hospitality. There's also some vacancies there. We've probably not been as successful as ramping that up as students, but we've definitely seen temporary working visas pick up a lot more.
Yeah. Thanks so much for coming on, Carlos. Before you do leave, mate, have you got a property Dumbo that you can share with us? Anything new been going on that you've heard about?
Oh, look, this is just one in my neck of the woods that I noticed. There's been an unusually high level of sales activity in my neighbourhood in Waterloo over the last couple of months, and two houses which on paper look quite the same, and I think just to me illustrate how sometimes the really immutable characteristics of a house can make a massive difference and expectations. They're both technically four-bedroom, two-bathroom houses, similar land size. One is a terrace on a quiet street. The other is a hodgepodge kind of cottage that you walk into. It's freshly renovated, but there's no flow. The bedrooms are all over the place. It feels like a student house where someone's put up a couple of extra walls and then done a kind of okay-looking reno on it. One of them sold well above expectations, did really well. The other one that's a bit of a hodgepodge is still on the market. They keep bringing down the reserve. It's just not a, you know, not a great property, and it's really dark. And I think, you know, it just shows you how much kind of on paper versus actually the feel of a house, the light, all those other aspects make a difference, particularly in a market like now where buyers are, you know, there's suppliers picking up, people can be more selective. They're not going to jump at the first potential lemon that lands in their lap.
Yeah, what you're talking about is exactly what we see and what we have seen for the last couple of decades that we've been in, you know, buying and, well, previously or selling property in Sydney. And that's exactly right, that when the market slows and becomes more manageable and more normal, then buyers become picky. And those things that you just mentioned there, they matter. And people will compete for something that's got the scarcity of the street, the floor plan, the position on the block, the aspect, all those sorts of things that they know are rare. They will fight for those, and you will see, you know, beyond expectation results for some properties. And the other stock that people think that they're going to create a four-bedroom home and therefore that's worth more than you know, whatever improvements they've made because they've got the wrong idea about what actually adds value to a property. We see it all the time.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, Carlos.
Thanks.
If you have a question that you'd like us to answer in an upcoming Q&A episode, you can send us a voicemail or written question via the website, theelephantintheroom.com.au, or you can email us directly at questions@theelephantintheroom.com. thebankers.com.au. If you like what you're hearing, please share this episode with others you feel would benefit. And while you're at it, why not leave us an iTunes review? 5 stars would be great. I know that sounds a bit cringy, but we have it on good authority that every review helps make it easier for other people to find out about us and hear what our amazing guests have to say.